That's almost 52 years so far, the world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water than the year before. Every year there's been less clean air than there was the year before that. Every year there are fewer species on the planet than the year before that. We're driving 200 species a day to extinction. We're about to see that turn around. The loving planet is about to make a comeback, and that's really, really good news.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This edition of Nature Bats Last, like future episodes, is pre-recorded. As a result, there's no chance to take your questions on the air. Our theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks by Afrizen. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud. I'm Pauline Schneider, and I'm here with Guy McPherson in New York. And Guy?
Thank you, Pauline. Pauline guests hosts Nature Bats Last each month, and she'll be covering the program again in 3 weeks. Tonight, she joins me as my hostess on the New York tour. And today we have the pleasure of interviewing Frank Coughlin. Frank is heavily engaged with Deep Green Resistance in New York City. He and DGR hosted a presentation and follow-up workshop last weekend. The workshop was titled Abrupt Climate Change, How Will You Show Up During Humanity's Final Chapter? Frank is a medical practitioner and a stunningly thoughtful human being. Thank you, Frank Coughlin, for spending time with us today on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, Frank.
Hey, how are you?
All is well, thanks. Again, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for inviting me.
So, can you tell us a bit about yourself? Do you have a career? What are your passions? That sort of thing?
Sure. Let's see, I guess I could start in kindergarten and go from there.
a little earlier might be helpful. We need real context.
Yeah. Well, my parents are devout Catholics, so I'm sure there's some Immaculate Conception involved.
Ooh, right.
Yes, I live here in New York. I live here in Queens. And I've been here in the city for the last almost 2 years. I work, I'm doing my emergency medicine residency at Bellevue and NYU Hospital, and I'm halfway through that process. And I'm originally from New York. I grew up on the Hudson River, a little bit north of here, and I have to say, never in a million years would I have ever thought that I would live here in New York City. And just kind of the turn of events, I have always been really interested in, I guess, like health and justice, and the ways that health can be used as a radicalizing and organizing force. And I think a lot of my thoughts on health really kind of changed when I was in school. I went to school in Boston, and I had always thought, maybe a little bit naively, that, you know, the revolution, the quote-unquote revolution, would likely happen abroad, and that I would, you know, train as a doctor and work as a doctor, and when that supposed revolution happened, I would go and fight or work in there. You know, kind of in the style of like a Che Guevara, or I think how many other people are brought up in the left here. Mm-hmm. And when I was in El Salvador, I was doing international health work in El Salvador, which is one of the top four countries in the world to be affected by climate change. It became very clear to me how selfish of an idea that was. That here I was with all the privilege and resources that in the world, waiting for, you know, essentially extremely oppressed and vulnerable populations to sacrifice their lives and their well-being for some, you know, supposed ideal, when all the things that specifically in El Salvador, they were fighting a lot of the effects of neoliberalism after their civil war, the effects of water shortages because of climate change itself, lack of rainfall, but then also a lot of land grabs and mineral grabs by a lot of the Canadian corporations that are heavily involved in resource extraction in the Central American areas, and facing a very real risk of having their entire water supply polluted by mineral mines, copper mines specifically, which would power smartphones and cell phones and kind of the other first world amenities that we all come to enjoy. And so it became very clear to me that all these things that these people are fighting are, they're fighting the symptom, and the cause is based in the U.S., you know, and so then therefore my responsibility kind of transitioned to the U.S. And so I became much more interested in the ideas of creating that resistance here in the U.S. And this is a post-Occupy. And so I decided to move to New York for some family reasons, but also more so to see what the, you know, the radical revolutionary or even just, you know, popular leftist scene was in the U.S., and it seemed that most of the things were coming out of New York. And so here I am in the belly of the beast, waiting, looking for some trees and some nature and all this, but also really enjoying the experiences of the conversations and the connections and really the training that I think a lot of the left is getting here in New York City. Kind of a little bit of a roundabout story of my life.
That's great. The revolution that you speak of, which, you know, started in South America, it's moving up here, people who become aware of the actual causes and, you know, of the symptoms that you mentioned, how do you, you know, Occupy Wall Street was part of that, you know, the grassroots revolution here. How else does that revolution look like to you in such, you know, in the city of Gotham? You know, we've been up there almost every day these past 2 weeks, and, you know, you're looking for the tree that grew in Brooklyn, and, you know, it's hard to find it. And there are so few people that get what you get, Frank, and, you know, where are they? What is, you know, how does DGR fit into all of that?
Yeah, I think it is, it's, to some degree ironic, you know, I see it when I tell people that I'm part of DGR, you know, first of all, being in healthcare, because there's often this misconstrued idea that, DGR's main message is that we need to stop industrial civilization and we need to dismantle it. And we have a strategy, you know, it's called decisive ecological warfare, where we essentially advocate for the development of a hypothetical underground, and that we have come to such a dire point right now that while we would love for a mass movement or regulation or lifestyle changes or something to that effect to enact the large scale, you know, kind of revolutionary changes that we feel, as well as the majority of probably the third world feels, need to happen. It's not going to happen passively, and it's not going to happen nonviolently. I think history is very clear telling us that. And so there's obviously often this confusion about how is it that a doctor could possibly be advocating for the dismantling of an industrial civilization, which produces industrial medicine, which is what I'm trained in. And, you know, critics will often claim will kill billions of people and whatnot. And I think a lot of that is related to the lack of connection that even people see here, I mean, it's slowly starting to come to see that the environmental catastrophe is a social catastrophe as well. I think for most people who are paying attention, I think Katrina was like that huge wake-up call of that the environment and this climate change are not for, you know, the upper middle class white Prius owning, you know, people following an inconvenient truth crowd.
Exactly.
It's also for the poor in Brooklyn and the poor in the Bronx and the immigrant that comes from Africa, the Latino worker who doesn't have immigration status, the undocumented youth that are coming from Honduras, that these things are all connected. And I think the way that we still work here in DGR in New York is working to try to connect those things, that we don't want to be an environmental group that shuns the city, because the city is real. You know, many people live in cities. There's extreme oppression that happens in cities, and I think that is a radicalizing force that, you know, similar to what happened with the Black Lives Matter recent protests, that the city is where those social revolutions, I think, can happen, and hopefully if we can help show the evidence or be a speaking wheel for those things, then we can help people make those connections in their head.
That's great. You remind me of a line from John Muir: when one tugs at a single thing in nature, he finds it attached to the rest of the world. And so tell us a little bit about Deep Green Resistance. I know this is old hat for you, but some of our listeners are undoubtedly new to the ideas of deep and green and resistance, much less the combination of the three. So can you fill us in and talk about those connections to the rest of the planet?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for asking. You know, I think at the base of it, Deep Green Resistance is based on a book. It's based on a book written by three authors, and the organization itself has come from that. And we're fairly new the last couple of years and still very much growing. But I also like to think of Deep Green Resistance as not just a group or a book or a movement, but just as a way of thinking about the world. A way of recognizing that this way of living, this civilized way of living, is killing the planet. It's killing millions of people every day through violence, through war, through famine and drought. Killing, you know, 200 species, probably including more, 200 species a day, causing them to become extinct. And at the end, I think it's also a culture that is killing us. When you look at the suicide rates and the oppression, the police violence that is happening, the state violence that is happening, and also the interpersonal violence with the rise of neo-Nazi and ultra-right-wing fascist groups, that this way of thinking and this way of enacting with the world is part of the problem. And we, among many others, you know, term industrial civilization, with civilization being the rise of a society that lives in cities. And so cities being groups of people where you overstep the landmass, the carrying capacity of that landmass, and you then need to import other resources. And to import other resources, you need to take them from some other land, which is usually inhabited by some other person. And so you need to either exploit or destroy that other species or population to continue your way of living. And so looking at it in that way, you know, the idea of civilization or even like a capitalist mentality of that extractive process, that this world is made for us to extract, and we will extract as much as we possibly can and sue the consequences. And so, you know, we look at that as kind of the primary, I guess the primary like fallacy, that human beings are the human supremacy of our way of thinking, and that all other systems of oppression derive from that you know, sexism and patriarchy, you know, racism and classism are ways of extrapolating and using those systems of power to destroy nature, to extract from nature. And, you you know, so I think that's like the green connection, which is connecting the environmental with the social. But then I think this idea of resistance is something I especially in the West, and I can only speak as a Western civilized person, something that is often talked about in very abstract ways and not really enacted. And part of what we're looking to do is to develop what we call a culture of resistance, this idea of where your only way of being could possibly be to use is something that is killing you, very similar to, you know, many indigenous cultures have that. We often look at like the Black Panther movement and their attempts to create an intergenerational culture of resistance. Lots of the resistance movements going on in British Columbia against the pipelines, in South America against neoliberalism or resource extraction in the Middle East. And this idea of resistance being, you know, a step, just drawing that line in the sand, that you can go this far, and then when you cross that line, like, you will not be allowed to, we will not allow you to do that. And not looking at the consequences of what that may be for us on an individual level.
Yes. I mean, of course, I find it very interesting that, you know, once people realize that they are part of this machine, this omnicidal machine, and then they step out of it, as you did, they start to be labeled as eco-terrorists, or committing crimes, or, you know, plotting or supporting the deaths of billions. Meanwhile, doing nothing will cause the deaths of billions anyway. Doing something is, you know, a different path, but it brings more awareness. I know that when I first heard about DGR, it was the principles of DGR were almost foreign to me, and I didn't, you know, it took me a while to digest the ideas, and, you know, it was quite a learning curve. Because you're so, you know, as a middle-class white woman who drives a Prius, you're so indoctrinated by the culture all around you that, you know, has, first of all, has raised, you know, one to be a good girl, an obedient girl, and also to, you know, to support your country and to be a patriot, and that anything that goes against it, whether ideologically or revolutionarily, is wrong, and you should fight it tooth and nail. And then once you start to see the, you know, you pull the veil back, you know, and you see the little man behind the curtain, and you realize it's all a joke, it's all a sham, and the people who are working the hardest are the slaves, and they don't benefit from their labors. And I think that that's something that people outside of this country are far more aware of than, you know, than Americans who, you know, go to work every day and they feel like they're, you know, they're, if you work hard, you're gonna get your, you know, you're right, you're just due. And that's not necessarily the case. I know a lot of people who work very hard, they have three jobs and they're not getting, you know, what's fair for them. And I think that's something that, DGR helps people become aware of. And I think, you know, I think it's a really important organization. It's very educational. And I especially as a woman appreciate the feminist aspect of it. And it was a refreshing, it was refreshing to me to see that men can be feminists. And I really, you know, I really thought that was, it was quite mind-bending as a woman who grew up in Greece, which is an incredibly masochistic, male-centric, patriarchal. It's just incredible, you know, for women to grow up there. So I'm assuming, and, you know, forgive me for making the assumption that you're a feminist.
Yeah, absolutely. A prerequisite. And it's interesting you say that because I think, you know, I think a lot of the the commentary on in BGR. I read the book and I was in El Salvador, which was a great place to read it because this is I was in a town that had 20 years ago just fought a civil war, and all the town was this leftist radical liberal, you know, leftist radical Che Guevara pictures everywhere, you know, people without arms and legs because they had lost them in the war. You know, this mentality of like, yeah, fuck the U.S., fuck neoliberalism, and if they want to build a bridge here, we're going to blow that bridge up. And, you know, that, like, that town just had this culture of it. And so I'm reading this book of, like, you know, resistance, and I'm like, yeah, totally. Then I go back and I start, you know, I sign up, and I'm you know, they have this enormous reading packet that you have to go through, and it was this, like, total destabilizing learning experience. But the most destabilizing was the feminist critiques, you know, the feminist aspects. And you know, I saw, like, how even my, like, masculinity had, I never thought feminism was for me to learn. Like, I'm not a woman. Why do I have to study feminism? And now looking back, I can see how that was like the foundation that connected me to many systems of oppression, you know, and those blinders. So yeah. And I don't know if I can call myself a feminist. I appreciate the term a recovering misogynist.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love it. It's funny because a few weeks ago I posted on Facebook, you're either a feminist or a misogynist. And I can't tell you how many people took offense to that. They did not want to identify as feminists. They also did not want to identify as misogynists. So that showed there's hope for them. But it was a really interesting sociological experiment.
Yeah.
Men and women, they were like, well, I don't really think I want to embrace the term feminist. And I thought that was ironic.
Yeah.
You know, we were at, we took Guy into the city and we saw Katie Goodman.
Okay.
One of his, you know, heroes, she was amazing, and she sang a song, you know, that, you're a feminist. And if you're a feminist, what that means is you like having a job and you like getting fair pay and you like having access to birth control and all these normal things that you would consider part of life.
Yeah, but it seems to me we're so programmed to find differences, to seek an other in the other. And so these labels we toss around are just another way for us to fall into that trap. You know, first they came for the communists and I was not a communist, and so on. That old mentality that I'm not part of that other, so therefore none of that nastiness applies to me. But of course, we are one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. We also look for commonalities. I find when you meet a new person, you're always saying, oh, I do that. I like that too. And you tend to do that more rather than finding your differences. I think politically and religiously, we look for those differences. Those are the sharper, more uncomfortable differences.
If people want the relatively short video version about DGR, they can find video from February 27th at the blog, guymcpherson.com. A short presentation by me is followed by an overview of DGR by Frank. So you can catch up with all things DGR in less than 30 minutes there with that video from February 27th.
That was the live stream.
That was the live stream that has been archived. That's mm-hmm. right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now it's posted from February 27th.
Mm-hmm.
So, Frank, we've interacted a little bit in the past. Can you tell us how this particular event came together, the one with the presentation and workshop last weekend that I just referred to? Tell us how it came together, and perhaps more importantly, why it came together from your perspective.
Yeah, I think, you know, we first interacted, we had a presentation last year that was kind of similar to this idea of, you know, I think maybe last year was kind of the year that I was first introduced to some of your work, and you know, I had come to accept that climate change is happening and that there's not really much hope for civilization. I had never heard timelines like the ones that you were putting out, or such a database of the feedback loops. And so, you know, we had seen a lot of your work, and I had saw that you were coming to New York. And so you were gracious enough to do a presentation with us about, you know, the reality of the situation. And then what can we do? And, you know, we were one of the answers of what to do, the DDR strategy. And I think, you know, this time around, the one we just did together was a continuation of that conversation. And you know, very similar to a lot of the grief stuff that you're doing, this idea of, we always start our presentations off with kind of a crash course in the reality of the world, that these are the statistics. This is like what the world really looks like outside of New York City, or in New York City, but just, you know, a little below the surface than maybe most people will see. And this is undeniable. This is proven. And that idea that this is the situation we're in, you can't turn away from this. And if this is the situation we're in, then where do we go from that? Like, how do we make what we call adult decisions based on the facts and the situations in front of us? And so I think in conversations with you and Pauline, that was very much what our theme was for the talk of, you know, your 10-minute crash course in the science of climate change and some of the timelines, which I think are great, and that I think, unfortunately, a lot of people get caught up on, is it going to happen in 18 months, or is it going to happen in 2 years or 20 years, and I think it's irrelevant at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, what do we do? Like, if we really feel that human habitation will die in 18 months, and that this engine, this civilization, every day is killing millions of people, is, you know, destroying 200 species a day, you know, we have these 400-something nuclear reactors that we have no idea what to do with, then, like, we better get to work. You know, our hope with coupling the two presentations together is that idea of, you know, DDR and DDR New York is just one answer. You know, I'm never going to suppose that this is the only way that anything can ever be done. But we just like to think of it as a way of thinking that, you know, we need to think about it. We need to think about some of the solutions that have been offered to us, like green energy, which anyone who reads any science behind green energy can see that it is it's a complete utopian fallacy. And then, you know, we need a strategy based on that, based on a reality of a situation. And, you know, our hope in the conversation that we had together was for people to come out with some action, you know, not necessarily a doable action, but some type of change in the way that they're gonna engage in the world. You know, be that they just read another article tomorrow, be that they come to the grief workshop that you hosted, they, you know, maybe take that next step and really accept the grief of climate change and whatnot. And then, you know, what I would personally hope is that people can even make those next steps. So, you know, well, then I'm going to do something. If civilization is the problem, then I'm going to help solve it. And, you know, we always advocate that that there are those people out there that will hear that message and are in a situation where they feel like they can form, you know, just like hypothetical underground and do this work that that unfortunately is probably really necessary right now. And so, yeah, we hoped for people to come out of that with some type of action for their life, that they not just go back on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and just, you know, that presentation was just a little dream, and, you know, I'm going to go back to my March Madness and my whatever, mm-hmm. You know, I don't know.
Yes. You're listening to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Pauline Schneider alongside Guy McPherson, and we're joined tonight by Frank Coughlin.
So, Frank, you bring up an excellent point that you want people to walk away from these presentations with action. I hear all the time, and I suspect you do too, that the message is so radical. Most people confuse that with extremist. And so dire, the situation is so dire that people are just going to to lay down and die or to despair, to get bogged down in despair rather than actually taking action. Ed Abbey wrote a long time ago, action is the antidote to despair. So do you want to talk about the response you've received, if there was any, and the kinds of next steps you encourage people to take once they've been exposed to the DGR message, they've had time to wrap their minds around it, they actually understand that civilization is an unmitigated disaster, and so on. Can you address some of that?
Yeah, I think I haven't received, you know, too much feedback from the recent talk. It wasn't that long ago, but you know, we've done talks like that before, and a lot of the feedback, I would say, kind of goes into a few categories. There's the one that just totally disagrees with it. And we were at a talk the other day where, you know, somebody just started the conversation being like, I don't agree with this. And they didn't feel like they wanted to go into more details about what exactly they didn't agree with, but it seemed like they didn't agree with this whole idea of near-term extinction, which I think is valid. And, you know, I really appreciated the fact that this person, had the courage to say, I just don't agree. And, you know, hopefully there have been other people at presentations that don't agree and they have, like, very specific points. I think one person at the talk on Friday, you know, was really kind of perseverating on the nuclear reactors, and which I think is a very valid point and a very valid concern. And I am not a nuclear scientist, and I do not have an answer for these 400 power plants. I don't know how to decommission one. I don't even know how anyone would go about decommissioning one. But just because I don't have the answer and DGR doesn't have an answer for it doesn't mean that it's still not a problem or that it's that we should just continue on. And so I think that's one category that kind of either they just want to deny or they have like factual things that they're maybe they hung up on. And then there are the people who you know, they see it and they're like, yeah, you know, I've always thought something was really fucked up, and I just didn't really have the language for it. Many of them are very scared. You know, they come up very hesitantly to ask of like, you know, so like, are you like student underground action and, you know, stuff like that. And we explain that, you know, we're an above ground organization and very much for security concerns. Like anyone in DGR is not involved in anything illegal except for civil disobedience, which is plus or minus legal in most cases. But that we don't engage in underground resistance or support or anything like that, a lot of because of security concerns, but that we openly advocate for it. And so for those people who are scared and those people who are interested, we have a list of resources for them, and that can go from, you know, just watching a YouTube video. Usually we recommend people watch NCIV, it's a Franklin Lopez film, on Endgame, which is a Derek Jensen book, but just talking about a critique of civilization and just kind of wrapping their head around what it is that they're thinking about. You know, there's other on our website, which is deepenresistancenewyork.wordpress.com, which is our local chapter. There's lots of news articles about different resistance movements across the country, and so we encourage people to do a lot of self-learning. We talked about feminism before. You know, feminism is also a way that people enter in, and so we encourage people to go and learn from that. And then there are other people who are already learned and they are already into it, and they want something more. And so we have some campaigns that are going on. Many of our members on the West Coast are doing stuff with the Unistoten camps up in British Columbia, with the water grabs in the southwest of the U.S., as well as abroad. So there's lots of projects for people to be involved in. And so those are, you know, they're great, and we always encourage members, you know, people who come up like that, that are excited and you know, I would say get it, quotation marks, to join it, because we're always growing. And then there's the third group, which is kind of right in the middle, and I think this is probably the majority of people, unfortunately, that see it, they hear it, and say that was really great, thank you so much, and then leave. And I've seen this a lot in my own family members, my own, like, very, very close friends you know, our relationship is such that they can hear my politics and think that I'm crazy, but they can still hang out with me and have a beer. And we don't have to oppose my politics. So I appreciate it. But I can also see in those relationships there's a reluctance. There's like a hesitation that they don't want to go any further. You know, they don't want to come to any more meetings. They don't want to read anything that I suggested they read. And I think part of it is that, like, that self-defense mechanism, be conscious or subconscious, that knows that if you start going into this idea that humans, as a civil, as a culture, as a way of a species, may are facing imminent death, that our way of life, like our smartphones, responsible for killing, you know, untold number of people, that it becomes really hard to go to work on Monday, and it becomes really hard to spend 40,000 hours on your wedding. It becomes really hard to think about your 401k plan. And I always make this joke with my friends at work of, you know, student loans, and I have, you know, hundreds of thousands of student loans. Of like, you know, I wish when I'm 90, if I'm still paying back my student loans, that I will be so happy for that. Because shit that I think about on a day-to-day basis, like, I'm not thinking about my student loans. And, you know, it's a joke and it's like an easy way for people, but then there's also the reality of like, I don't really see the American economy lasting more than 20 years. And so I'm not going to plan to retire. And that becomes really hard for people who are not there yet. And so I just encourage people, we have this saying in DGR, you know, we need everything. We need the 18-year-old who has tons of underground skills to go out and build a hypothetical underground. We need the 30-year-old who has a newborn to raise that newborn in the best way they can. We need the 80-year-old writing letters to prisoners. Like, we need it all. Mm-hmm. And there's always a way for people to engage, be it just reading an article or, you know, joining a resistance movement in the next year.
We had 17-year-olds at your event, and we had young people in their 20s. It was quite a mix.
Yeah, people's responses are quite varied, of course. Even on this trip with events a few days apart, the responses were stunningly disparate.
Yeah.
You know, consider this email message, which I received a couple of days ago. Hi, guy. Jonas here from Spoonbill Books. Abrupt climate change prevented me from attending the Woodbine event. It looks like it prevented you from getting there, too. I apologize for hooking you up with these people. Should have vetted them more. Didn't realize they were vacuous wankers, sophomoric, shamelessly self-aggrandizing, unserious, purposely unintelligible, unable to call anything anything, callous, energetically stupid. I thought they were concerned about abrupt climate change, but it seems they are not. I've rarely seen such a raw and gratuitous display of sophistry. This from a guy who hosted me just a couple of days earlier than that at a bookstore, and obviously, you know, living a not very far away from that other event he went to, observed quite the spectrum of responses to my message. So did you want to comment on that? Because you were at both of those events too, as well as the event you organized sandwiched in between. And the responses are really telling, I think.
Yeah. You know, I have to laugh at that because, you know, all like personal things aside, you know, I think that that's really one thing that with the city, I don't know if it's a New York City thing or if it's an American thing, but like, you don't even need the right. Like, we don't need the Tea Party because we will destroy ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, DGR right now is in this like huge controversy of between radical feminists and queer feminists and you know, when I walk into a room and I say that I'm from DGR, sometimes we are kicked out, other times people have never heard of us, and other times people are totally ambivalent. And you know, here we are talking about like the end of literally the end of human civilization, and we're kicking people out of different organizations and movements and solidarity actions because of like politics.
Right.
But anyway, I'll get off my soapbox about that. But I think it is really interesting. And you know, I also noticed too, like when I go abroad and I see, I hear people talk about climate change. They don't have this like theoretical language that we have. They don't have the science behind it. But what they do have is that they're like, you know, it doesn't rain anymore. And if it keeps going like this, our family's gonna die. And if that company comes in and takes and builds a dam to block our river, we're gonna die. And, you know, and they have such a different way of thinking about it. And also it's a much more basic reality, I feel, where, you know, it's not this like hypothetical we're gonna die, it's like, yes, we will die. Like the cancer that my daughter has is from this country. And I'm positive of it, even though I don't have the studies and the science. And they also live with, you know, an oppression, I think a more tangible oppression than we face here in the city. And it is interesting to hear, you know, some older folks that have been in some of the talks and there's a lot of, I feel like pontificating on what the death of human civilization would be and what would that look like. I think there's a lot of like the 30-something who is still grappling with this idea that that American dream that you were all sold about going to college is not true. And now we're still trying to wrap our heads around how do we have some level of comfort but not be too bourgeois and not be too part of the, you know, not like our parents, but we kind of want, you know, things that our parents had, idea. And then you have this other, you know, the people in the Bronx who are being killed by the NYPD. You know, maybe they don't talk about climate change, their conversation about oppression is very real and very explicit. And yeah, I think everyone's dealing with their own grief, to use your term, in their own, you know, their own very disparate way.
Yeah, you know, I've come to call the situation of the last several decades the new American dream. That's the version of you get something for nothing. And in the consummate case, you get everything for nothing. And it's pretty obvious that the millennials are not going to get something for nothing. That we're in the age of economic contraction at this point, and it's not going to go in the decades ahead as it did in the decades in the past. I also tend to think Goethe was right when he pointed out some two centuries ago, quote, none are more hopelessly enslaved than those who falsely believe they are free, end quote. And what most people fail to recognize is that civilization, and especially the worst and most recent form of civilization, industrial civilization, is a cage. And we're trapped. None are more hopelessly enslaved than those who falsely believe they're free. You know, you don't have to go very far, not even in fact out of this country, to find places where you can't grow food, where you can't harvest rainwater, where you can't live off the grid. So, you know, with the exception of food, water, and energy, it seems we got all the freedom we need. So,
didn't you read today that the California drought is permanent now?
Yes, there's a study that was just conducted and it's just been published within the last couple of days that the California drought is now the forever drought. Yeah. And, you know, there are consequences, there are costs to the way we live and what we do, and the proverbial chickens are coming home to roost now. And it's ugly. And as you pointed out, it's especially ugly for people who are not living in relatively wealthy countries. You know, the people in Central America, for example.
They seem to be more aware of it, though.
Yeah.
They're more connected to
That's right. They're connected to the earth. You know, they actually go outside.
Yeah.
They don't have smartphones that they're packing around all the time and looking at and bumping into signs.
Right.
And don't make a joke about me at this point, please.
Well, we tried, for example, we were coming into the city and it was snowing up here and we were concerned that the weather was going to turn and be terrible down in the city. So we called the folks in the city and they didn't even look out their windows. They said, well, I guess it's okay. I mean, there's the trucks are going to go out and salt and, you know, that's what they should do. And I was just thinking, can you look outside and see what kind of snow is coming down?
But really they didn't even think to go outside.
It's
just a weird thought. Maybe I'll look on the Weather Channel, but really it's all going to be taken care of.
Right. Yes. The water will be brought. The water will be put in the stores. It will be pumped into your tap. It will all be taken care of for you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a funny place here in the city.
Yeah.
I used to think the city, you know, one of the reasons I moved here was I really thought that just the level of oppression and the level of inequality existing in the city, it would force things to happen here. I think some things can happen here, but I also feel like we're just so disconnected from any materiality, from any tangibility, that it just really limits. It limits how fundamental we can really get to.
Wow, yeah. That's true, even with the big park.
Yeah.
Yeah. The perfectly manicured pesticide field park.
Right.
So I hate to make this all about me. Okay, that was a lie. Let's talk a little bit more about the workshop and the people who participated. You were there for the duration. You helped set it up. It was in a wonderful venue. There were 14 participants and Pauline and I facilitating. Were you satisfied with the outcome? Did you get much of a vibe from anybody as they were on their way out the door, or maybe at the final break? And did you get the impression that it was useful, helpful, a waste of time? What's your take on it? I know it's fresh in your mind, so now's a good time to talk about it without thinking too much.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. You know, and first of all, I would just want to say a thank you to Project Reach for helping us with the two events and for a lot of the youth organizing work that they're doing in Chinatown. But, you know, I have to say I didn't have much expectation. And I think you purposely made it that way, with not much of a description on the course and things. And I thought it was really great because, you know, I've noticed that I'll speak for myself, only, in that, you know, I went to college, I went to graduate school, I work at a high intellectual level, you know, I tell people, that they're going to die, I tell them that they have cancer, I tell them that their loved one is not doing well, they're always in this extremely theoretical, intellectual way. And there are times where, you know, that the humanity of the situation kind of breaks through, and you get people who break down and they remember that one patient for the rest of their life and so on and so on. But then you go back to your shield is up. And I think here in the city and just in general, a lot of us have this shield of, you know, I'm not vulnerable. And I've just been thinking a lot about vulnerability recently and thinking about even some of the things that I do to be vulnerable are not really being vulnerable. You know, I write some poems, and maybe I put my poems up on a website, but that's not really being vulnerable because I also think the poems are pretty good. And, you know, part of me wants, like, other people to validate that. And if they don't validate that, well, then I didn't really care about their opinion anyway. And so I'm not really being vulnerable. And I thought one of the amazing things about the workshop is here I am telling other people about some grief that I had, you know, that in the preparation for the workshop that, A, I had thought I was over, that I clearly was not over, and that I still grieve, and that was not a bad thing, that it's okay to grieve, and some days are better than others, and more than likely I'm never going to get over that grief, and that's fine, like that's how humanity is. And also that grief that, you know, that I felt about this event is the same type of grief as, you know, the 5-year-old who lost a teddy bear, and that was the most devastating thing that ever happened to them when they were 5, and they carried that grief, or, you know, the one who was beat by their parent and, you know, had tons of trauma and tons of violence and the grief that they suffered, and, you know, not that they're all the same, but they're the same feelings of grief. And just that vulnerability to be able to talk about that, about things that you probably have not, you know, I had not really talked about with the closest friends, the complete stranger. And then it made it that the second half, you know, the first half is more of this individual, you know, how was your personal group, and then the second half being this kind of larger climate change group, and that, you know, when we were able to see somebody as a, like a full human being, with all the vulnerability and like all the beauty that comes with that, then, you know, people would say things that I didn't necessarily agree with. I thought, you know, politically, I was like, I don't really agree with that, but that there was like this compassion there that, yeah, I don't agree with you, but like we're in this together and like we're kind of the same. And, mm-hmm. you know, let's figure those differences out, from a level of understanding that, that we both have compassion now for each other. And then how do we transfer that to somebody else? You know, and I thought there, I think Pauline, you said something about how grief or this whole process of accepting climate change reminds you of how fragile we are,
mm-hmm.
Like as a species, as a physical body. And I'm like suffering of an injury right now, and it's like a reminder of the fragility of your body. But then also that psyche, like you're just a very fragile species.
Yeah.
Very fragile mind, and you have to be careful of that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I thought it was really great, and it's definitely something that we talk about here in New York a lot, about, you know, being kind and being compassionate to those who maybe don't agree with like the BGR strategy or the BGR way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. maybe they're, you know, the idea that industrial civilization is evil and it's going to collapse is utterly devastating for people, and that we should be really compassionate about that.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
It is. It is devastating to some people, you know, the notion that we're going to lose so much of the culture that we're all embedded within is truly horrifying for some people, and we've met a few of those on this journey. You know, in this last 2 weeks here. And I understand that. And I understand people's fear as well and the difficulty they have in getting out of the headspace and moving on. So we have just a minute or two left. Can you tell us, Frank, what's next with your work, either for you personally or for DGR?
Yeah, as far as DGR, we're very much building. We are now engaging in introductory sessions. We have DGR 101, which is an introductory session, and then a DGR 201, which you do on a monthly basis. I kind of go over the nuts and bolts. And so if you're interested in learning more about DGR, in New York, you can go to Decaying Resistance New York, all one word, .wordpress.com, and you can sign up for our email list, and you'll get all our social media events. In the springtime, we're going to be doing some foraging walks with some people in the parks here, and just trying to do some skills learning, as well as we will be presenting at some of the major things coming up, like the Left Forum and the U.S. Social Forum coming up in the spring and the summer. And in addition, we're very much in this idea of building alliances, and so we do a lot of things to build alliances with the Black Lives Matter movements, the Indigenous movements here in New York, as well as some of the more other environmental movements. And as a region, as a Northeast region, we're contemplating the connecting with other campaigns, especially around the extractive processes, with New York kind of center of a lot of the new pipelines that are being built, and seeing how we can fit into those larger pictures. And yeah, we're all trying to build a community here, a culture of resistance, to help us try to figure out a way to resist and to create autonomy and liberation in that.
That's awesome, Frank. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. Frank Coughlin, this has been wonderful.
Thank you, Frank. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, guys. Thank you, Pauline.
We'll call you next time we're out here.
All right.
Me too.
Great.
Take care.
You too. So that about wraps it up this week. Please make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well if you haven't. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.fm. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show, and please continue to follow Guy's blog, guymcpherson.com, for further updates, essays, and speaking tours.
I'll be headed to California tomorrow check out the blog to find out where I'll be in your neighborhood.
We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday evening. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at prn.fm and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to all the excellent contributions this week and to Afrozen for the music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
That's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water than the year before. Every year there's been less clean air than there was the year before that. Every year there are fewer species on the planet than the year before that. We're driving 200 species a day to extinction. We're about to see that turn around. The loving planet is about to make a comeback. And that's really, really good news.
Coming out swinging, she bats last and she's just about taking all that she can take. And it's payback time, motherfuckers, it's payback time. I said it's payback time, motherfuckers, it's payback time. For the strip mine plan, for the boys in seas, for the dead species, for GMO, for uranium ore, for screwing your kids for a few dollars more. Now it's payback time, motherfuckers, it's payback time.
The loving planet is about to make a comeback. The loving planet is about to make a comeback. The loving planet is about to make a comeback. And that's really, really good news.